Some gave all. In the annals of American history, no group stands out more heroically than the military. As the United States of America was literally born in blood as a result of the American Revolutionary War. While the first American army may have been a ragtag group of amateurs, when General Washington gathered them, they inexplicably, or perhaps predictably, lost many battles and yet won a war against the world's superpower, the British Empire. By the time of America's Civil War, the United States had grown to be a world player, yet the Civil War, living up to its name, was an internal struggle. More extraordinary, the Civil War, which almost destroyed America itself, was a struggle of conscience launched to decide whether the powerless minority would be emancipated or held by chains in perpetuity. Says one national biographer, quote, "The Civil War is the central event in America's historical consciousness. While the Revolution of 1776-1783 created the United States, the Civil War of 1861 to 1865 determined what kind of nation it would be. The war resolved two fundamental questions left unresolved by the Revolution. That is, whether the United States was to be a dissolvable confederation of sovereign states or an indivisible nation with a sovereign national government. And second, whether this nation, born of a declaration that all men were created with an equal right to liberty, would continue to exist as the largest slaveholding country in the world." Now, Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address stated 47 years ago, "Our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure." Lincoln was articulating the supreme irony of our Declaration of Independence as opposed to Americans in chains. So, of course, today we salute those who fought to free all Americans in the original war, in the Civil War, and every other battle which America waged. And, of course, more specifically, our fallen heroes, all who dedicated themselves to protecting and stoking the eternal flame of American liberty. So Lincoln's entire Gettysburg Address, 47 years ago, "Our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. On a great battlefield of that war, we have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus so far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth." Good morning, Kelly O'Connell here, and doing a live show. It is 6:10. Today is the 30th, the last Monday of the month, which is when Memorial Day falls. And we are celebrating all of the men and women who have fought and died for our country. Now, here is a little bit of the history of Memorial Day. And what I've decided to do, and this is pretty ambitious, is I want to go through all the different wars that America has been in, just briefly, just to remind us where we came from Memorial Day comes out of the Civil War, but we do celebrate all the people that have fought and died for America, for which, had they not done so, this country would not exist. And we also remember the men and women, the brave men and women who still fight and work to defend this country. Here's a little bit on the meaning of Memorial Day.
Welcome to WatchMojo.com, and today we'll be learning more about Memorial Day. Memorial Day is a U.S. federal holiday that remembers those Americans who have sacrificed their lives for the nation. Each year, it falls on the last Monday in May. Memorial Day began as a time to commemorate the soldiers who died during the American Civil War. In the early 1860s, people all over the country were gathering to pay tribute to the fallen during the spring. The event went nationwide in 1868 after the Grand Army of the Republic leader designated May 30th as Decoration Day and later Memorial Day. In an attempt to honor the service of Civil War veterans across the United States, General John A. Logan asked that their graves be decorated with flowers. That same year, General and future U.S. President James A. Garfield gave the speech at the very first Decoration Day at Virginia's Arlington Memorial Cemetery. Since General Logan was commander-in-chief of an organization for Northern Civil War vets, many Northern states followed suit and eventually adopted Decoration Day as an official holiday. However, those in the South maintained their own commemorative activities for several decades to remember the supporters of the Confederacy's cause. After the First World War, the holiday began honoring all Americans who died while fighting in all wars. Memorial Day's traditional date was then moved to the last Monday in May, and it soon became associated with the start of summer and all the festivities that entails. Memorial Day has been observed with several traditions and events over time. This includes the National Moment of Remembrance at 3 p.m., where every American is requested to take a one-minute pause. Many Americans continue to stop by cemeteries either to pay tribute to the late soldiers or to visit the graves of loved ones. Others may find themselves at the military-inspired parades that are held in several cities.
All right, here's a little bit more on Memorial Day. And this is called Honor Thy Fallen, a Memorial Day tribute.
Memorial Day, originally called Decoration Day, is a day of remembrance for those who have died in service of the United States of America. Born out of the Civil War and a desire to honor our dead, it was officially proclaimed on May 5, 1868, by General John Logan, National Commander of the Grand Army of the Republic, in his General Order No. 11 as Decoration Day. On the first Decoration Day, General James Garfield made a speech at Arlington National Cemetery, and 5,000 participants decorated the graves of the 20,000 Union and Confederate soldiers buried there. The first state to officially recognize the holiday was New York in 1873. After World War I, the holiday changed from honoring just those who died fighting in the Civil War to honoring Americans who died fighting in any war.
My great-grandfather served with Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders in Cuba, and my grandfather and my uncle served in World War II. And many of them had friends who perished. They served in the Navy, the Army Air Corps, and the Army itself. And so around Memorial Day, I always remember as a young child that it was very important for them to get together and pay respect to those who are no longer with us.
Millions of American fighting men and women have fallen in battle. Their valor and sacrifice made possible our freedoms, our values, our very existence.
Memorial Day is for our fallen heroes, our comrades, our brothers and sisters in arms who paid the ultimate sacrifice.
A time where the world kind of takes a break and recognizes those fallen warriors who have gone before us to give us the freedoms that we have today.
Memorial Day also has been a time for us to remember family members by planting flowers. During World War I, military families started a tradition of hanging a small banner in the windows of their homes. The banner had a white background, a red border, and one blue star for each family member in the military. If a family member died in service, a gold star replaced the blue. That gold star has become a simple, cherished symbol of a loved one who has passed.
It's important that they get recognized as a family and understand that their family paid the ultimate sacrifice. Their loved one had, but their family still lives with the memory of those their fallen brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, mothers, fathers. And so Americans should recognize them, at least thank them for their family member's service, and try to empathize with them on the sacrifice that they paid, especially on Memorial Day.
Today, many Americans choose the Memorial Day observance as an opportunity to decorate the graves of beloved family members and friends who have passed away. People visit local cemeteries, place flowers and wreaths on the graves of veterans and other loved ones who have made an impact on them by the lives they led.
2 years ago, on May 7th, 2012, we lost a really good friend, somebody that was a big staple in my hometown, Private First Class Dustin Gross. Went to a high school with him, grew up playing baseball with him, football, was on the wrestling team. You know, he's loved by everybody there. He was in Afghanistan, and IED blew up his Humvee, and so it killed him and two other people riding with him. He was only 19 years old whenever he died. He's forever missed. He was a really, really good man to know.
Sacred to all war veterans, it is a day of recognition of those fellow soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen who have fallen defending liberty.
Say thanks to people who paid ultimate sacrifices like my buddy Dustin did. You know, it goes a long way, and it makes you really feel like people still support you and still believe in the cause that you died for.
It is a time to reflect on who we are remembering. We take the day to remember the loss of Americans who died defending their country throughout the world since 1775. These men and women came from all walks of life and regions, but had one thing in common: love and loyalty to their country.
Most of us, servicemen, women, we have family, we have children. I myself have a one-year-old daughter. It's very hard on us, and we do sacrifice a lot to be where we are right now.
Memorial Day is exclusively for honoring those who died serving in uniform during wartime and peace. This remembrance is all-inclusive, spanning 239 years and as many as 62 military actions that claim over 1.2 million lives.
If you know of a family or of someone who has fallen in conflict, say thanks. You know, send your regards and your prayers out to them and let them know that you appreciate them.
I just want to say thank you to all the servicemen and women who, through their selfless service, have made the ultimate sacrifice for this country and for our freedom. And I want to thank their families as well.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife, I thank my lucky stars to be living here today. But the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that life to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. But there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Memorial Day to me means sacrifice. I would like to thank all those who have served and fallen before me, and all those who serve with me today.
From the lakes of Minnesota.
Well, we'll take a break right here. Kelly O'Connell, 621-523-1450 to call in. We'll be back. Happy Memorial Day, folks.
From sea to shining sea.
All right, so here is a summary. Here is a summary for you of all of the wars we've been in, and they're all 5 minutes or less, kind of a thing. But I'll intersperse some news for you in between as well. And let me give you some headlines here before we dive into this. Thump receiving a thunderous reception, and Trump's numbers are up. Hillary's numbers are down. For the first time, Trump has passed Hillary in the Real Clear Politics summary of all the polls. And there's a great deal of fear and frustration in the Democratic Party about what's going on, because nobody really predicted this, that since day one, Donald Trump was not going to make it as the party's nominee. But if he did, he would be absolutely obliterated by Hillary Clinton. And now, funny enough, getting rid of 17 opponents, Trump is now, he's now on his own. And Hillary is in the fight of her life for the Democratic Party nomination, and it is possible that she could win California, which would be a total disaster. She could lose California to Bernie Sanders. So very, very weird. Lots of heavy rains. Bonnie is tracking there on the East Coast, and there has been an amazing amount of rain in Texas. And last Friday, I believe it was, they got 19 inches in Houston. So I had mentioned to you before, there was we're already talking about historic levels trying to multitask here, but this is a new computer and it's working very well. I'm thrilled. We've got some just tremendous amounts of rain that came down into Texas. 19 inches was there, and I've got a little clip on that from USA Today.
Six people have been killed from the severe floods in Texas. Four bodies were found in Washington County, which is in between Houston and Austin. Two others were found in Travis County near Austin. Officials suspect one of the bodies found in Travis County might be one of the people missing because of the flooding in the Lone Star State. So far, two towns near Houston have issued mandatory evacuations, largely because of the high waters in the Brazos River, which is expected to reach a record level of 53 feet by Tuesday. In other areas, authorities issued mandatory evacuations in subdivisions for residents who were in danger. Two prisons near the Brazos River were also forced to evacuate amid dangerous flooding. As many as 2,600 inmates are being transferred to other prisons in the state. The heavy rain began Friday. The Weather Channel predicts more heavy rain will hit Texas this week from Tuesday night to Friday morning. For Newsy.
All right, so it's extraordinary to watch what's going on in Texas and see that just day after day, week after week, month after month, so many thunderstorms, and now we've got these epic tornadoes. And what you need to do, if you can possibly get close to the video and look it up, just go to YouTube and look up tornado, and just some of the biggest tornadoes you've ever seen. And as you know, these cameras are getting better and better. You know, and these storm chasers are just absolutely fearless. You'll see just stunning amounts of, in these epic tornadoes that are coming down and tearing houses to shreds and barns and devastating neighborhoods and stuff. All right, here is today, thunderstorm forecast for today, and I see that it is across El Paso and Las Cruces. And when I was coming into work today, I did see that there was clouds on the horizon towards Deming, and there were lightning shots. So, but here's a little bit on today's weather throughout our region and into Texas and up into the center of the country.
Storms along the 20 corridor, I-10, as well as I-80, I-70. So many interstates are going to be impacted by the threat of severe weather today. The red zone basically goes from North Dakota all the way down to the Rio Grande. Here's a look at the situation for tomorrow, because we do think there's still going to be more thunderstorms, which could turn severe. We've got the moisture that continues to flow up from the Gulf. Couple of pockets of severe weather we'll be monitoring for those of you heading back to work and even school. School's still in session in some parts of the country. So the Twin Cities over into Wisconsin, and also watching Oklahoma down into western Texas. That's going to be your best chance for damaging winds, large hail, and isolated tornadoes. But the overall tornado threat, thankfully, is not running all that high. Dew points, they're going to stay up there, and we're going to continue to watch out for thunderstorms as we head towards Wednesday, some of which could be severe as well.
All right, and here's just a little bit more. I don't know, I've never seen anything like it. And, you know, California was lucky to get a lot of rain from El Nino, but I don't know where all of this rain going into Texas is. Here's a little bit more. And these are both clips from the Weather Channel.
Now, of course, Wednesday is the 1st of June, and we've got a couple of areas to watch in terms of severe weather. Big area of general thunderstorms, but severe around the Great Lakes and severe down here in deep south Texas between Houston and San Antonio. So here's a look at our rainfall forecast. Keep in mind, this is on top of saturated ground because we have had so much rain lately in the heart of Texas. So the yellows and oranges where we could see at least 3 inches of additional rainfall. Houston, your skies look pretty quiet, thankfully, for Tuesday, although it's going to be warm and muggy. Wednesday, we bring in that chance for some hit or miss storms, and even Thursday still looks pretty stormy out there.
All right, so the last area to discuss is the tropical depression that is on the East Coast, so I'll just get you a little bit of that here. But so we've got this tropical storm that comes up, as they always do, along the eastern seaboard area from the Caribbean up, and it didn't hit Florida, but it did form and then take a left turn around South Carolina. And if, as you recall, South Carolina had so much rain during the last giant weather event that they said if you took the rain that had come into South Carolina and put it into California, the entire state would be cured of its drought instantly. So here's a tropical depression, Bonnie.
Three from the National Hurricane Center at 5 a.m. has it moving at only 3 miles per hour. And for a time yesterday, it was stationary and not moving at all. And that's why we've been seeing the problems with flooding right along the South Carolina, North Carolina border, even down here in eastern Georgia. So the winds are 30 miles per hour. I wouldn't be too concerned about the wind, actually. But the fact that it is moving so slowly and we still have that persistent onshore wind, rip currents are still going to be a threat for us today. There's a look at the position. You can actually see it with the wind streams on the map, that counterclockwise flow showing where the center of circulation is right now to the east of Charleston. And with that tropical moisture, you're seeing quite the enhancement of rain this morning across the Outer Banks of North Carolina, up towards southeastern Virginia as well. It is really dumping on those beaches out there, unfortunately. So not the best beach weather, but that might be good. You may not want to go in the water anyway, because we do have a high rip current risk across the Outer Banks of North Carolina, right on down towards Myrtle Beach. But even as far south as eastern Florida, that rip current risk is there with us as well, about a moderate risk. And as we go through the next few days, look at the movement. Not moving a whole lot, but probably losing tropical characteristics by the time we get towards Wednesday into Thursday.
All right, so I'm looking at the local weather here. The Doppler weather shows that there's just a very few clouds out there, but they some of them were headed in this direction. Today's weather, 9 degrees right now. High is going to be 89 degrees and mostly sunny. And 58 is the low tonight, and so 89 tomorrow. So warm, but not too hot, I guess. All right, let's take a little Let's take a little break here, and we'll come back and start going through these wars in the history of America, which I found kind of interesting. And here's Lee Greenwood, the guy that sings this song, doing it live right after 9/11, the attack. This is the 2001 World Series Game 4. So we'll be right back. 6:35, Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. 523-1450 to call in. And we'll take a little break and start digging into these, the history of American war, and in honor of the fallen heroes that made America possible.
We think of the Atlantic hurricane.
And a little bit of bleed over here, but anyway, great live performance here.
Yeah. If tomorrow all the things were gone, work for all my life, and I had to start again, just my children and my wife. Thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. That I'm proud to be an American, who very least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. 'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
All right, starting off with the Revolutionary War, here's a quick summary. How did we get formed as a nation? Well, here's that first war, and the men that and women that died, I don't know how many women died, but I guarantee you some women died in that war, helped found the country. Without that war, of course, we would have never declared independence and then written a constitution, the first modern constitution in the world and the first Bill of Rights. Check it out.
Hi, everybody. Let's take a look at the Revolutionary War, which pitted the 13 colonies against England and would give birth to the United States of America. First, let's take a look at some of the causes, and the first one being the French and Indian War, also known as the Seven Years' War. Here, England united the 13 colonies to drive France out of North America. However, England, in order to pay off some of this war debt, began to levy taxes against the colonies. Colonists were angered by these taxes because, one, they were expensive, and two, they had no representation in the British Parliament, lest we get that famous expression, no taxation without representation. And after a series of protests and skirmishes, it eventually leads to all-out war. And for the sake of time, I'll only outline some of the key military engagements here. And the first one being in the spring of 1775, we get the Battle of Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts. It's also known as the shot heard around the world. And this is considered the first military engagement of the war. And here's where Paul Revere and others warn the towns of Massachusetts that the British are coming. And the Minutemen engage in guerrilla warfare. The next key engagement is the Battle of Bunker Hill in Boston. And this is soon after Lexington and Concord. And here's where the colonists stand their ground but are eventually overrun by the British. The key importance of this being that this is a big confidence booster for the Minutemen, for the colonial militias. Next, we get Valley Forge, and this isn't actually a battle, but this is where the Continental Army camped out in Pennsylvania, and it's key because during this time, in the winter of 1777, morale was very low for George Washington's army because of a series of defeats, and then there's a lot of disease, and then bitter cold racked the troops, and here George Washington exhibited his famous strong leadership qualities and motivated his troops to stay in the fight. And probably the biggest turning point of the war was the Battle of Saratoga in the fall of 1777. And here's where the Continental Army defeated the British forces in New York. And France, who had been watching this Revolutionary War unfold from afar, was still upset about their defeat in the Seven Years' War to the British. And they determined after this victory at Saratoga for the colonists that the colonies were for real. And thus, they decided to join the war as their allies. And now America had a major world power and all the benefits that came with that. The French Navy, French naval power, French troops, and even some of their leadership. A lot of people say, without the French support, very good likelihood that the United States would not have won the Revolutionary War. And then the battle that kind of ends it all is the Battle of Yorktown. It's the fall of 1781, and here's where George Washington and his French allies surround the British in this port town in Virginia. And the French Navy created the naval blockade so the British could come in and resupply. And then George Washington and his army surrounded by land, and the largest British force in North America is forced to surrender, effectively ending military engagements. And it all ends at the Treaty of Paris in 1783, and England has to recognize the 13 colonies as the United States of America. Now, let's wrap up with some of the effects of the Revolutionary War. First of all, this is bad news for Native Americans, because now settlers will begin widespread settlements west of the Appalachians, which was technically illegal under British rule because of the Proclamation of 1763. This is also bad news for slaves in America. England was beginning to doubt the slave trade. The United States, however, was very much in favor of it. But at the time, England controlled an empire that stretched around the world. The fact that a group of ragtag colonists could rise up and pull off victory would set the stage for revolutions across Europe and the rest of Americas. The United States now controls all 13 colonies, which was the land from the Atlantic coast to the Mississippi River. They were free to trade with any country as opposed to only trading with British-controlled areas. Although this initially becomes difficult due to the pirate attacks the United States has to endure because they had always had the protection of the British Navy, now they could trade with whoever they wanted, whenever they wanted. And at the end of the day, the United States of America was the first country to overthrow their colonial master and establish a republic, which the world had not seen since ancient Rome 2,000 years earlier.
Whoa. All right, so here is the next war, which is the Civil War. And, here we go. Here's the Civil War is where Memorial Day comes from, those celebrations, Decoration Day. Oh, okay, and I brought up for you here the deaths associated with the various wars. Total service members in the American Revolution, 217,000. Now, if you consider that the colonies were just a few million people, that's pretty amazing. Battle deaths during the American Revolution, 4,435. Non-mortal wounding, 6,188. And okay, here's your clip on the Civil War.
The seeds of the Civil War were really sown when the Founding Fathers framed the Constitution. You're going to have an agreement in there, the three-fifths compromise, in which, you know, slaves were sort of sometimes people or three-fifths of a person, and a series of compromises and issues throughout the 19th century, the first half of it, is going to only make that issue more and more complex. In 1820, trying to keep parity in the Senate between slave states and free states, you're going to have a compromise where one of each state enters the Union. You're going to have a slave uprising, Nat Turner's Rebellion, which is going to foment fears in the South about more slave uprisings. You're going to have a war with Mexico, which Yankees in the North would see as a war of Southern conquest, where you have people in the South starting to frame the argument that states should be able to decide whether they are free states or slave states. That's an interesting thing. Throughout this time, by 1840s, you're going to have this argument of us against them. It is North against South, South against North. It's the same country. They spoke the same language. But the perception of North and South was growing to make a wider gap. By the 1850s, you're going to have the Compromise of 1850, which is eventually going to destroy the parity in the Senate. But it's also going to forgive some debts for Southern states, as well as adding a fugitive slave law, which is going to force people who might even be against slavery to be complicit in it, to return slaves to their masters if they escape into non-slave holding areas. You were going to have, of course, Uncle Tom's Cabin come out, which is going to sell more than a million copies in the first couple of years You are also going to have, of course, John Brown's raid, which is just going to make these passions stronger. And these erupt into literally people bringing guns into the Senate chamber. You're going to have Kansas erupt into what is now known as Bleeding Kansas, where pro-slavery forces from Missouri come in and fight against anti-slavery forces from New England. And eventually this stuff will all erupt and come to a head in the election of 1860, when Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, a liberal Republican, who said he wasn't going to free any of the slaves or tamper with slavery where it already existed, was perceived by the South as being hostile to slavery. And that is the reason the Southern states gave as they seceded in 1860 and early to mid-1861. And the Civil War will begin at Fort Sumter in April 1861. After the firing on Fort Sumter, both sides, North and South, started to raise huge, enormous armies. The biggest armies in the world eventually will gather on this continent. You're going to have them gathering around Washington, D.C., and also in the West. The North immediately institutes a blockade of southern ports, which eventually will have a huge impact upon the South, especially given in the West a series of victories at Fort Donelson, at Shiloh, at the capture of Corinth, Mississippi, and eventually later in the war when Vicks falls and then Chattanooga falls. The South, especially in the West, is being shrunk, while you're going to have in the East a series of battles fought by a series of Northern commanders, generally against Confederate General Robert E. Lee, in which the troops are going back and forth from Manassas down to outside of Richmond, up toward Manassas again in Antietam, and then down in the Fredericksburg area, up to Gettysburg, and down slowly, inexorably, toward Richmond. As the war wears on, the southern territory is shrinking, the blockade is really working, and ultimately, by the end of the war, April 1865, southern forces are compelled to surrender, namely at Appomattox and at Bennett's Place in North Carolina. With the end of the Civil War also came the assassination of President Lincoln. Lincoln, who had emancipated the slaves as a war measure on the first day of 1863, who was so key in passing the 13th Amendment. But his assassination itself did not help relations between the North and the South. And he was just one of so many as a result of this conflict that would die. 620,000 dead. As a result of this conflict, some suggestions are that that number is way too low, actually. So it's important that we reflect back upon the Civil War, what it means to our country, and that is one of the reasons the Civil War Trust is so interested in saving so much battlefield land. 30 acres of battlefield land are lost to development every day.
Wow. And so 620,000 people died, according to that figure, and then others saying it's too low. And I was reading last night some of the descriptions of the Civil War, that people would walk through towns where there had been battles a year later and they could still smell the bodies of the dead decomposing, because there were so many graves that had been dug, and many of them were close to the surface, and so they had for years birds flying down and feeding off the dead. It was terrible. Total number of fighters for the Union, which was the North, 2.2 million. Battle deaths for the Union, 140,000. Other deaths, 224,000, so that's 360. And then for the Union, non-mortal wounding, 281,000. Total service members for the Confederacy, over a million. Battle deaths, 74,000. So you see that the North lost a lot more soldiers. And then other deaths, 59,000, although 600,000 or more is a good number to keep in your mind. That is what helped to create Memorial Day. We will take a little break here and come back and finish up the first hour. Kelly O'Connell, celebrating Memorial Day by going through our various wars and remembering the fallen heroes that helped build America. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450, a special show. We'll be right back. 652.
From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston and New York to L.A.
All right, so 6:55. And so remember when the guy that was the head of the Justice Department, Eric Holder, got up and said Americans were racial cowards? My response to that would be 600,000 dead doesn't satisfy you. 600,000 people gave their life to decide whether we were going to be to own slaves. So I think that's a pretty major achievement. All right, here's 12 stunning Civil War facts. More soldiers died in the Civil War than any other American conflict. 2/3 killed by disease. Gettysburg wasn't the only unusually bloody battle. More Americans were killed in 2 days at the Battle of Shiloh than in all previous American wars combined. The Battle of Antietam was only 1 day long but left 12,400 Union soldiers killed, missing, or wounded, higher than the typical estimates of Allied casualties on D-Day. With 23,000 casualties overall, it was the bloodiest single day of the Civil War. At Cold Harbor, Virginia, 7,000 men fell in 20 minutes. Nearly 56,000 soldiers died in prison camps from starvation and disease, a quarter of those deaths happening at just one camp, Camp Sumter. An estimated 40% of Civil War dead were never identified. Amputation was the treatment of choice for broken or severely wounded limbs. Surgery wasn't sterile. There was no anesthesia on the battlefield. African Americans made up less than 1% of the North's population, but were 10% of the Union Army. 20% of soldiers were under 18. Women secretly fought in the war, and the estimated cost of the war was $6.19 billion, or $146 billion in today's dollars. Whoa. As of 2014, the Department of Veteran Affairs is still paying Civil War pensions. And here's 10 more facts from CivilWar.org. Civil War was fought between the North and Southern states from 1861 to 1865. Lincoln was president. Slavery was the issue. Civil War began when the Southern troops bombarded Fort Sumter. The North had more men and materials than the South. The bloodiest battle of the Civil War is the Battle of Gettysburg, which seems to be contradicted by the last factoid. But getting just about to the end of the first hour. And appreciate you tuning in on this special Memorial Day broadcast. We're going through these wars one by one. We'll come back and bring you some headlines and then get into a few more wars that defined America, including the ones we're still in. And it is about 6:59, and we have Lee Greenwood singing live at World Series Game 4, 2001, right after 9/11. And we'll be right back after a break on the hour.
Well, there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say, that I'm proud to be an American, who at least I know I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me, and I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. 'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died, who gave their right to me, and I gladly stand
Good morning. If you're just tuning in, Memorial Day starts off in the Civil War. Decoration Day, it becomes, first it's celebrated by the North, and then after X number of years, it becomes celebrated by all the states and becomes Memorial Day as opposed to Decoration Day. Decoration Day, I believe, had to do with putting flowers and markers on graves, wreaths and such. All right, here is a little statement from Ronald Reagan from Memorial Day.
If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Freedom and the dignity of the individual have been more available and assured here than in any other place on earth. The price for this freedom at times has been high, but we have never been unwilling to pay that price. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. Each one of those markers is a monument to the kind of hero I spoke of earlier. Their lives ended in places called Belleau Wood, the Argonne, Omaha Beach, Salerno, and halfway around the world on Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Porkchop Hill, the Chosin Reservoir, and in 100 rice paddies and jungles of a place called Vietnam. Under one such marker lies a young man, Martin Treptow, who left his job in a small town barbershop in 1917 to go to France with the famed Rainbow Division. There on the Western Front, he was killed trying to carry a message between battalions under heavy artillery fire. We're told that on his body was found a diary. On the flyleaf, under the heading My Pledge, he had written these words: America must win this war. Therefore, I will work, I will save, I will sacrifice, I will endure. I will fight cheerfully and do my utmost as if the issue of the whole struggle depended on me alone. We must realize that no arsenal or no weapon in the arsenals of the world is so formidable as the will and moral courage of free men and women. It is a weapon our adversaries in today's world do not have. It is a weapon that we as Americans do have. Let that be understood by those who practice terrorism and prey upon their neighbors. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
All right, would you rather listen to Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama? The question answers itself. All right. Here's just a few more interesting facts from the Civil War, which was the war that killed more people than the rest of the wars combined, I believe. And 10 surprising Civil War facts from the History Channel. One third of the soldiers who fought for the Union Army were immigrants, and nearly 1 in 10 was African American. 2, black Union soldiers refused their salaries for 18 months to protest being paid lower wages than white soldiers. 3, Harriet Tubman led a raid of free slaves parade to free slaves during the Civil War. IV, Lincoln was shot at and almost killed nearly 2 years before he was assassinated. 5, before William Tecumseh Sherman became a great Union general, he was demoted for apparent insanity. Yes, Sherman is the guy that launched, up to that point, probably the most ruinous and extraordinary campaign in history, his famous march to the sea, in which it was a scorched earth campaign where he laid waste to everything in his path. He burned everything, killed everything. All right, 6, General Ulysses S. Grant wasn't the bloodiest general of the war. Robert E. Lee was. Both before and during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln pushed to send freed slaves abroad. 8, Robert E. Lee's Virginia estate was confiscated by the Union and turned into a cemetery during the war. 9, privates weren't cannon fodder during the Civil War. Generals were. Robert E. Lee impulsively personally led a counterattack during the Battle of the Wilderness, and et cetera. 10, more men died in the Civil War than any other American conflict, and 2/3 perished from disease. All right, so let's get into our next war here, which is World War One. Summary. And we tried to avoid both World War One and World War Two, but we were drawn into it.
In 1914, the tensions generated by international rivalries exploded into general war. The spark that led to the explosion occurred in the Bosnian town of Sarajevo, where Serb terrorists assassinated Austrian Crown Prince Franz Ferdinand. Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, and an intricate chain of alliances began to draw the great powers into the war. Two sides formed, the Allies and the Central Powers. Russia was first to mobilize its army, coming to the aid of Serbia and provoking a German declaration of war. Bound by a treaty with Russia, France mobilized too, and when Germany violated the neutrality of Belgium, Britain declared war. Other European powers were soon drawn into the conflict, and eventually it turned into a global war, with the United States joining the Allies in 1917. Combat began on August 4th, when a German task force crossed the Belgian border and soon overran the country. 8 days later, Austria invaded Serbia. Russia attacked Germany, advancing into East Prussia and also striking at Galicia in Austria-Hungary. After achieving a major breakthrough in France, the German offensive began to stall just 15 miles from Paris. On the Eastern Front, the Germans met the Russians at Tannenberg and inflicted on them a crushing defeat. On the Western Front, the Allies counterattacked at the Marne, driving the Germans back. And at Ypres, they fought off a German drive to capture the vital Channel ports, with both sides racing to the sea in an effort to outflank the other. By Christmas 1914, the Western Front was stabilized, and a solid line stretched from the English Channel to Switzerland. On the Eastern Front, the Russians withdrew from East Prussia when the Germans attacked Poland. In the Caucasus region, the Turks seized Russian and Persian territory, but were driven back in January 1915. On the Eastern Front, Germany and Austria prepared for a new offensive. Launched in May, it advanced the front line 300 miles and resulted in 2 million Russian casualties. New Allied offensives in France achieved little, and at Ypres, the Germans initiated the use of poison gas with horrifying consequences. Italy entered the war in May, but in a series of fruitless drives at Austria, lost 280,000 men in 6 months. In an attempt to knock Turkey out of the war, the Allies launched an invasion at Gallipoli, but badly organized, it was abandoned in 1916. In the Balkans, armies from Austria, Germany, and Bulgaria finally overwhelmed all Serbian resistance. The Germans renewed their Western offensive in 1916, attacking Verdun with the deliberate intention of bleeding white the French army. The defense of Verdun left over 500,000 French casualties. The Allies began their own counteroffensive at the Somme, where the British used tanks for the first time, but the attacks achieved little more than horrendous casualties. In the east, the Russians began the Brusilov offensive across a 300-mile-wide front. It was finally checked when German reinforcements were rushed in from Verdun. Encouraged by early Russian successes, Romania joined in the offensive, but the country was eventually occupied by Austro-German forces. The one major naval engagement of the war, the Battle of Jutland, fought in May 1916 between the main British and German fleets, ended indecisively. Elsewhere, Allied forces captured some Albanian territory, but lost ground in Greece while Russia advanced in Turkey. The British also advanced in Mesopotamia, and Colonel T.E. Lawrence, soon to gain worldwide fame as Lawrence of Arabia, helped organize an Arab revolt against the Turkish Empire. Anticipating a new Allied offensive in the spring of 1917, the Germans withdrew to the Hindenburg Line. In the attacks that followed, French casualties were so heavy that soldiers resorted to mutiny. Before the Germans could take advantage of the French setbacks, the British began a new offensive. They suffered 240,000 casualties at the Third Battle of Ypres. The Italians renewed their attacks at Isonzo, achieving some success at first, but German troops were rushed to the front and driven back in catastrophic retreat. Italy lost 275,000 men as prisoners. The Allies suffered a worse setback when revolution toppled the Tsar. As the Russian army disintegrated, the Germans recaptured lost ground, and in December, the Bolshevik government signed a truce with Germany, effectively ending Russian participation in the war. In the Middle East, the British took Baghdad, and breaking through Turkish defenses in Palestine, entered Jerusalem. By 1918, fresh American troops began to reach the Western Front in increasing numbers. The Germans planned a final assault before American manpower could influence the outcome. Shifting forces from the Russian front, they began a series of thrusts at the Allied lines and eventually reached the Marne again. Newly arrived American troops stanched one German offensive and in the counterattack seized Belleau Wood. The Germans renewed their efforts, but with American troops arriving at a rate of 300,000 a month, Allied counterattacks repulsed them. Having suffered 500,000 casualties in 5 months, the German army was spent, and the Allies took the initiative. The Americans attacked in Saint Mille and also spearheaded the Meuse-Argonne offensive. Although the Central Powers occupied huge areas of Russia, their war effort was collapsing. The Allies advanced in Italy, in the Balkans, and in the Middle East, and continued their offensive on the Western Front. With its forces in retreat, Germany asked for an armistice. On November 11, 1918, the fighting stopped. The Paris Peace Conference of 1919 imposed stiff reparations on the Central Powers, redrew the map of Europe and the Middle East, and sowed the seeds for a second world conflict that would erupt 20 years later.
All right, so how many were killed in World War One? Total number, 38 million, 17 million deaths and 20 million wounded, the casualties. So 38 million casualties. All right, well, I don't understand that. But 11 million military personnel were killed, 7 million civilians. So that's 18 million right there. And for America, we lost, we had to have 4.7 million, about 4.75 million men, women involved. Battle deaths, 53,000. And non-theater deaths, another 63,000. And non-mortal woundings, 200,000. So an extraordinary cost of that war. All right, so sorry that was a little bit boring, but let's take a break here. That throbbing music in the background, the guy was kind of monotone, but all the way through World War One in 6 minutes. 721 Kelly, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450 to call in, and we'll be back. We're celebrating Memorial Day. And here is one of the greatest Star-Spangled Banners ever.
America, especially the brave men and women serving our nation in the Persian Gulf and throughout the world, please join in the singing of our national anthem. The anthem will be followed by a flyover of F-16 jets from the 56th Tactical Training Wing at MacDill Air Force Base, and will be performed by the Florida Orchestra under the direction of Maestro Yaha Ling and sung by Grammy Award winner Whitney Houston.
It's Kelly.
Hello. Hi, Kelly. It's Toby. I just wanted to say that I don't find any of this information that you're putting out boring. It's very historical, good information. I think a lot of people need to know this.
I don't even know half of it, to be honest, as I'm listening to it. So,
I don't either, but it's good stuff.
Now, I didn't hear your name because I was still turning up the radio.
Toby.
That's what I thought. How's it going?
Good, good. Thank you.
What are you doing for today?
Just kind of relaxing, taking a little time off work.
Good.
I'd even go see one of the memorials or something.
That sounds fantastic, man. Thanks for calling in.
You bet.
Happy Memorial Day.
Bye-bye.
And 726 here. Now, they're still trying to launch a third-party bid. William Crystal is trying to do it, and he's an idiot. And it appears that Mitt Romney is still trying to do the same thing, and people in Utah are starting, according to reports, are starting to hate Mitt Romney's guts. So, it's just so crazy. All right, so here is... As you know, if you know anything about World War II was the dream of one insane person, or If he wasn't insane, he had a different way of looking at stuff. Adolf Hitler, check this out.
Adolf Hitler was a fanatical leader, a megalomaniac who led his country and many others into the abyss.
Some historians believe that Adolf Hitler thought that his mission in life was to rid the world of Jews. That even if he didn't build the Third Reich for 1,000 years, he would be celebrating for eliminating the Jewish population from the world. I don't know how you begin to deal with that kind of madness, but that's who he was.
Adolf Hitler was born in Braunau am Inn, Austria, on April 20th, 1889. Hitler's childhood was an uneasy one. His father died when he was very young, and he was not a good student.
In his teen years, in his pre-war Viennese life, you start seeing the attractions to the anti-Semitic and rabid anti-Bolshevik attitudes.
His name was not Adolf Hitler, you know, it was Stuckelberger, and he was a corporal in World War I. But suddenly he was the man who was giving voice to a long history of German pride. The consequences of World War I for Germany were extraordinary. I mean, the victors, the Western Alliance, placed such penalties on them that they could barely survive. And so they were open to the idea of someone like Hitler who could give voice to their most base fears. And he very cannily knew just how to do that.
Hitler, very quickly after World War I, began to engage in political activity, joining and helping start the German Workers' Party in 1919.
This party later became the Nazi Party.
In 1923, Adolf Hitler conspired with other right-wing politicians to overthrow the Republic.
In response to this, Hitler was sentenced to prison, where he wrote Mein Kampf, expressing his radical, rabid beliefs.
That was at Landsberg prison. This commentator made a mistake. Nazism is not right wing. It's left wing. The difference between Nazism and communism is the economic approach to economics. Communism believes in ownership by the government of all economic activity and all production. Fascism, which is the Nazi and the Italian approach. And I've got a book just on this topic. Is where the government directs the economy but does not take ownership. But it directs the economy in such a way that if any business tries to deviate from the government's plans, that business will go out of business very quickly. So anyway, just to let you know.
He was irrationally anti-Semitic, and he was able to use anti-Semitism as a tool for his rise to power.
In January of 1933, Hitler becomes chancellor. As a result of the fire of the Reichstag in February of 1933, Hitler is afforded wide-ranging police and political powers. He's able really to begin the process of forging the dictatorship, the totalitarian state.
People who thought about international policies were very concerned about what Adolf Hitler was up to, because you would see those great rallies in the streets of Berlin with hundreds of thousands of people marching in uniform and goose-stepping their way down the Platz and raising their arms in salute to Adolf Hitler. And then he invaded Poland.
He thought the British and the French would not declare war on him, and it would be a quick campaign to subdue Poland. But on September 3rd, 1939, Britain declared war. France followed suit.
In June 1941, Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, starting the largest land war in history. In December 1941, Hitler also declared war on the United States.
World War II was fought on 6 of the 7 continents. 50 million people perished. The United States, Great Britain, and the Western Allies were aligned with Russia to try to crush Nazi Germany, Italy, and Japan.
Hitler felt adamant that it was his duty to mankind to rid the world of all Jews, and he ordered all possible resources and manpower to fulfill this horrendous task in the so-called concentration camps, the death camps.
The Allied invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944, marked the turning point of the war. In less than a year, Germany would surrender to the Allies. An estimated 6 million Jews were killed during World War II.
In May of 1945, Adolf Hitler committed suicide together with his wife, Eva Braun, who he married just before that.
I think of all the tyrants in history, you have to put Adolf Hitler.
All right, so here is, well, we'll take a break and come back and check out World War II. Kelly O'Connell, 732 AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOB, 523 1450. We'll be right back. Happy Memorial Day. We'll be right back. Here is the Korean War, a brief recap.
At the end of the Second World War, and emerging from nearly four decades of brutal Japanese occupation, the Korean Peninsula found itself torn between two foreign ideologies, from the Soviet Union and the United States. Following Japan's defeat in 1945, the Soviet Union occupied the communist wing of the Korean resistance, all of the land north of the 38th parallel, while the United States occupied Korea south of the line. The communist north was equipped with over 200,000 armed veterans who fought alongside Mao Zedong's Chinese Red Army against the Japanese, and then against Chiang Kai-shek in China's own bloody civil war. Their leader was Kim Il-sung, who saw the United States appointing former Japanese collaborators to top leadership positions in the South. His intent was to unite Korea under one communist ideology. By contrast, the unstable South was ill-equipped to defend itself compared to the battle-seasoned and well-supplied North. From 1945 to 1950, the South, under the leadership of Syngman Rhee, suffered massive civil unrest, often dealing with popular demonstrations with violent police retaliation, employing tactics reminiscent of the Japanese occupation. Following years of cross-border raids and skirmishing along the 38th parallel, Kim Il-sung invaded the South on June 25, 1950, behind a barrage of artillery fire. Syngman Rhee was forced to flee Seoul 2 days later. On the third day of fighting, the South bombed the bridge crossing the Han River and were in full retreat from the North's advance. On the day of the invasion in 1950, the United Nations Security Council in New York roundly condemned North Korea's action, with veto-wielding Russia infamously absent from the session. 2 days later, Security Council Resolution 83 was passed, recommending UN member states assist South Korea militarily. And with that, American President Harry Truman ordered the U.S. Navy and Air Force, based mostly in Japan at the time, into action on behalf of the South. Less than 2 months since the invasion began, Kim Il-sung had driven the South Korean and U.S. forces.
I just realized I put the Korean War before World War II. Please forgive me.
To Busan, in the southeast corner of the peninsula, and was expecting an imminent and total victory in the war. At the time, China decided to position more than 250,000 of its troops along its Korean border should the conflict escalate and the North's advance be repelled. After weeks of fighting around Busan, the U.S. had significantly reinforced the South while American bombers degraded the supply lines and troop strength of the North. The army of Kim Il-sung was forced to retreat. Only 25,000 North Korean soldiers ever managed to rejoin their northern ranks. The South's counterattack successfully pushed across the 38th parallel and, along with U.S. forces, captured the North Korean capital of Pyongyang. In response, China ordered its troops to cross into North Korea and repel the South Korean counteroffensive on October 25, 1950. Following 2 months of brutally contested warfare, U.S. and South Korean forces were expelled from North Korea back across the 38th parallel. By January 4, 1951, North Korea had captured Seoul for a second time. However, as before following its invasion of the South in June 1950, North Korea lacked the logistical support to supply any further pursuit of the South. This gave U.S. and South Korean troops time to quickly regroup, rearm, and retake Seoul. After 6 weeks of back-and-forth fighting, the U.S. launched a full-scale assault against the North Korean and Chinese forces in February 1951. For the rest of the year, fighting continued around the 38th parallel, steadily degrading into World War I-style trench warfare, brutal and mechanical. As casualties mounted on both sides, efforts at negotiating a ceasefire grew. However, several attempts at diplomacy were thwarted throughout 1952 and into 1953. With Korean civilian casualties approaching 3 million, a proposal was finally accepted by the United Nations, and an armistice agreement was signed on July 27, 1953. The result led the embittered North and South Koreans to create a demilitarized zone roughly along the 38th parallel, which has perpetuated the hostility of the two countries for six decades.
Don't forget that General MacArthur wanted to invade China, but that's another story. All right, here's, and pardon me, and how many people died in Korea? 5.7 million Americans there, and battle deaths, 33,000. Other deaths, 2,000 in the theater. And 17,000 non-theater, and non-mortal woundings, 100,000. All right, here's World War II.
The First World War was meant to be the war to end all wars, but its crippling effect on the global economy and the harsh restrictions imposed on the losing side meant that by the 1930s, trouble was brewing. Adolf Hitler swept to power in 1933 in a wave of German nationalism. Japan had already invaded Manchuria and had bigger ambitions for its global empire. In the space of 9 months, starting in September 1939, Nazi forces rolled across Europe with the latest in mechanized war machines, taking in Poland, Denmark, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Belgium, and France. And that put the UK on the front line. The Battle of Britain raged in the skies with nightly bombings of the country's major cities. In London, the Blitz saw the city attacked from the air for 57 consecutive nights. But the UK's resilience caused the Nazis to call off plans for a full ground assault. In 1940, Italian forces pushed into Africa, invading Egypt and bringing Northern Africa into the war. From there, World War II sped into overdrive, splitting most of the world into Axis and Allies. The Nazis invaded Russia. Japan continued its invasion of Southeast Asia. And on December the 7th, 1941, it launched an offensive that woke the war's sleeping giant. Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor in Hawaii sent shockwaves through the United States. And after 2 years on the fringes, an attack on its home ground pulled the U.S. out of the sidelines and into the battlefields. In 1942, the tables began to turn. Japan's Navy suffered a crippling defeat as it attacked the U.S. outpost of Midway. In North Africa, British troops drove Axis troops out of Egypt. The following year, the Nazis' drive eastward collapsed as a bitter Soviet winter led to the surrender of German troops in Stalingrad. In July that year, the Axis lost one of its original partners as Allied forces toppled Mussolini and restored Italy's king. But though the tide was turning, the war ground on. Then came June the 6th, 1944. D-Day, the biggest invasion in history. More than 5,000 ships, 11,000 planes, and more than 150,000 servicemen. Europe's major ports were heavily guarded, the beaches less so. So under a full moon, the Allies stormed them. British forces took Sword Beach and Gold Beach. The Canadians took Juneau and the Americans, Utah and Omaha. With a foothold on the mainland, Allied forces were unstoppable. Paris was liberated in 2.5 months. And by April the 25th, 1945, Soviet troops from the Eastern Front had Berlin surrounded. On May the 8th, the war in Europe was over. In the Pacific, it continued for another 3 months before America's nuclear bombs forced Japan's surrender, ending what remains to this day the deadliest conflict in human history. Max Foster, CNN London.
That's short and sweet. And here is 60 million died in World War II and 400,000 Americans. Now, here's a little bit on Vietnam. Buckle your seat there. Put on your seatbelt. This will be fast.
This was the longest war in the history of the United States. Welcome to WatchMojo.com, and today we'll be learning more about the Vietnam War. As part of the Cold War, the Vietnam War was a struggle against communism and an effort to limit its expansion.
If this little nation goes down the drain and can't maintain our independence, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other little nations.
In 1954, Vietnam was split into two zones at the Geneva Conference. In North Vietnam was the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which was a communist state led by Ho Chi Minh. South Vietnam was non-communist, and its first president was Ngo Dinh Diem. By mid-1955, Diem initiated a campaign denouncing communism. Suspected communist activities were punished with jail time and even death. His regime lost popularity to the point where a significant portion of South Vietnam supported the communists. This prompted a guerrilla campaign to pop up in the South in late 1956. Named the National Liberation Front, this movement was more commonly called the Viet Cong. As directed by Ho Chi Minh, they used armed propaganda to fight their battles. This targeted violence was initially aimed at politicians, but grew more widespread in the hopes of unifying the country under one communist regime. In an effort to limit the expansion of communism into neighboring countries, the United States began training forces in the South towards the end of the 1950s.
It's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them, we can give them equipment,
it's Kelly.
Send our men out there as advisors, but they
Kelly.
Have to win it, the people of Vietnam, against the communists.
At it's
this
Kelly,
time,
who's
with
this?
Support from the U.S. government,
and
the coup was being
discussed.
However, Diem was
I can't fit everything in, man.
On November 2nd,
1953. Well, it's important.
Without
the Columbus Raid, we have a lot
Americans.
Of people here died.
His death caused the political climate.
Well, maybe I'll mention
to
it tomorrow.
I got to try
to get Desert Storm in.
In August 1964, two alleged attacks on American warships were reported off North Vietnam's coast in the Gulf of Tonkin. This gave the U.S. the ammunition necessary to get more heavily involved in the conflict. That year, the number of U.S. troops deployed had risen to 16,500 from only 2,000 a few years earlier. The war escalated, and in March 1965, a series of aerial bombing attacks by U.S. and Vietnamese forces against North Vietnam commenced and continued for 3 years. During that period, Operation Rolling Thunder dropped 1 million tons of missiles, rockets, and bombs on the North. With support from the American public, the U.S. ground war also began in March 65. 3,500 Marines were sent to the South for a defensive mission, and by December, that number had risen to 200,000. However, the ARVN forces of the South experienced great losses in a number of battles over the next few months, and morale dropped. The United States then decided they must intervene even further in order to win the war. Prior to this, they had insisted it was up to the Vietnamese to end things. President Lyndon Johnson and his administration tried to spin the war and its progress in the American media by highlighting stories that showed the war's progression.
All the challenges have been met. The enemy is not beaten, but he knows that he has met his master in the field.
This made the media and the public mistrustful of the government. The Tet Offensive proved to the Americans that progress was not, in fact, being made. On January 31, 1968, the VCs made a surprise attack on the southern Vietnamese and Americans. They responded quickly and effectively. However, the fight raged for months and killed President Johnson's chances of re-election.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country.
By the time he left office, approximately 30,000 American lives had been lost fighting in Vietnam. When President Richard Nixon entered office in 1969, he began withdrawing troops. The policy called Vietnamization was put in place and was meant to help prepare the Arvins to take over the battle. Amid even more attacks, U.S. public support plummeted further, especially after the National Guard killed four student protesters at Kent State University. Peace protests became commonplace on American soil by 1972, and the Vietnam War became a central issue in that year's presidential campaigns. After Nixon's re-election, he was able to negotiate an agreement that ended American involvement in the war.
A ceasefire, internationally supervised, will begin at 7 p.m. this Saturday, January 27, Washington time. Within 60 days from this Saturday, all Americans held prisoners of war
throughout Indochina will be released.
Signed January 27, 1973, the Paris Peace Accords resulted in a ceasefire throughout the country and the release of American prisoners.
All right, so that's the end of Vietnam War. Now, somebody just called up and complained that I skipped the Spanish-American War. I've got a little quickie here. We'll see if it has got anything. This is about 2.5 minutes.
The island of Cuba lies only 90 miles from the United States. A colony of Spain since 1492, Cuba exported sugar, fruit, and tobacco to the United States and the rest of the world. American investors, by 1880, had spent millions of dollars in Cuba. In Cuba itself, movements for independence from Spain had a very long history. By 1880, the Cuban insurrection...
I hate to say this, but I'm going to move on. I may be hated for that, but there's bigger wars. All right, here's Persian Gulf wartime, Operation Desert Storm. We're running out of time, folks.
Saddam Hussein called this the mother of all battles. Welcome to WatchMojo.com, and today we'll be learning more about the Persian Gulf War.
Should military action be required, this will not be another Vietnam. This will not be a protracted, drawn-out war.
Relations between the United States and Iraq were strained for years due to Iraq's alliance with the Soviet Union during the Cold War and their stance on other world conflicts. Despite this, the U.S. helped Iraq in the war against Iran during the 1980s. While this battle helped build Iraq into an important power, it also left the country broke. In addition, Iraq's economy suffered because of low oil prices they blamed on overproduction by Kuwait. In July 1990, Saddam Hussein's regime threatened military action should they continue. Saddam also hoped to erase the debt his country owed Kuwait after the Iran-Iraq War. He wished to expand Iraq's presence in the Middle East by controlling Kuwait's huge oil reserves and by annexing the whole country. Due to the region's history, he already considered Kuwait as part of Iraq. The neighboring countries failed to find a compromise, so Iraq launched a surprise invasion of Kuwait on August 2, 1990. Saddam claimed victory within a couple of days. Meanwhile, the United Nations hoped for a quick and diplomatic end to this occupation. Iraq refused a UN request to withdraw, so the country was put under a total trade embargo. At this point, the United States, under George H.W. Bush, worried that by invading Kuwait, Iraq had gained easier access to neighboring Saudi Arabia and its vast oil reserves. The U.S. hoped to contain Iraqi influence and prevent Saddam's regime from controlling the majority of the world's oil. On August 7th, the U.S. and a coalition of Western allies deployed troops to Saudi Arabia in a mission called Operation Desert Shield. This military action was based on an earlier plan created by the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Central Command, General Norman Schwarzkopf, otherwise known as Stormin' Norman. In November, the UN gave Iraq a deadline of January 15th to withdraw from Kuwait. Otherwise, the coalition would be permitted to respond with force. Until January, the U.S.-led coalition presence in the region grew to include soldiers from 34 countries, including Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, and Egypt. This group was led by Schwarzkopf. On January 16, 1991, when Saddam's military remained in Kuwait, Operation Desert Storm began.
5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
Coalition forces had a significant technological lead over their opponents, so this aerial offensive saw the demolition of Iraq's air support, as well as much of its infrastructure and important buildings. Iraq responded tactically by attacking Israel with Scud missiles. Saddam assumed he could cripple the coalition with this move because Israel had a policy of retaliation. He knew that Arab nations...
All right, so we know what happened there. We totally obliterated them, and then we pulled out. Now, here's a little clip why America invaded Iraq the second time, if we can squeeze this in.
United States go to war against Iraq in 2003. The decision was controversial at the time and remains so today, but the reason was clear. Saddam Hussein, the brutal dictator of Iraq for 35 years, was the central threat to peace in the Middle East. With that threat removed, the Bush administration believed the establishment of a functioning democracy in Iraq would encourage the growth of democracy elsewhere in the Arab world. As democracy spread, terrorism would retreat. But it is on the stained life and career of Saddam Hussein that we need to concentrate in order better to understand why the United States felt forced to act in 2003. We begin with the Iran-Iraq War, which Saddam started in 1980 and which lasted until 1988. 1 million people died in the course of the decade-long struggle. And during that war, weapons of mass destruction, or WMD, especially poison gas, were used on a regular basis by both sides. Once his war with Iran ended, instead of building up his shattered nation, Saddam decided to embark on another lunatic adventure. In 1990, he tried to grab 10% of the world's oil supply by invading Kuwait. His brief annexation of Kuwait proved to be another disaster. The mother of all battles, as Saddam called it, turned out to be a three-week rout, his Iraqi army utterly defeated by a US-led coalition. But rather than trying Saddam as a war criminal, America and the West allowed him to stay in power. This appeasement eventually led Saddam, once again, entirely the wrong conclusion.
All right, folks, out of time here. Thanks for tuning in. Kelly O'Connell Show, happy Memorial Day, and I hope you guys have a great